Good enough.
All right.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
Hello.
Hi, everybody.
Welcome to Hard Knocks Film School.
Yeah, welcome back, or welcome for the first time, I guess.
Maybe.
I don't know.
We don't know.
It's only episode 3.
We're not judging you.
Yeah.
I'm Chloe.
And I'm Tim.
And we're here to teach you guys and hopefully ourselves about film.
Yeah. And we're back with a whole new list of things to talk about from 1891 to 1894.
Last episode we covered up till 1891 with Dixon Greeting. So we're picking up with 1892.
Oh, okay.
And we're covering up until 1893.
1893, okay.
Because next episode we'll have quite a bit to talk about for 1894.
Yeah. But first we should probably talk about the movie, which we told everybody we were going to watch.
And which we did.
Yeah, we did.
So The Magic Box, the semi-accurate biopic.
Semi my butt. That was not.
About William Freeze Green.
Yeah.
From 1951 with Robert Donat.
Mm-hmm.
Donat. It's hard not to say Donat. Donat.
Donat.
D-O-N-A-T.
Yeah, he was English, so.
And he was a great British actor, but he died just a few years after they made that film. I guess he had brain cancer.
He was a treat to watch. I enjoyed that.
It was directed by John Roy Bolting, and it actually came out in 1952, even though I thought it was 1951. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, anyway, it was extremely watchable. I don't know what I was sort of expecting. Maybe a more boring documentary
it's
style.
It's a lukewarm review.
well, all right. So it has the niche appeal of being about film history, which you and I are obviously interested in, as are probably most people who are going to be listening. But, you know, outside of that, it was a cool story.
It's mostly a little love letter to William Freeze Green and his contributions to early film.
Yeah, they have the little homage where they sort of recreate his street scene. And then there's also a scene where they recreate sort of the scene in Hyde Park, right?
There's a scene where he is going to Hyde Park with his camera once he finally gets his camera. He like finishes making it.
Or he takes delivery from the instrument makers or whatever, which I'm not sure if that was accurate or not. I don't know how much of a hand he had in building that camera or in sort of just conceiving of it. Anyway.
Yeah, because these two people just sort of show up and they're like, okay, we finished your camera for you.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that was weird. I wasn't sure about that either.
Well, it seems like he went to London for purposes of having access to like the people who were making all of the camera parts. Because he was mostly just like a photographer. I don't think he wasn't a machinist or anything. But yeah, it was a beautifully done love letter. But it was that. It was a love letter. It wasn't an accurate biography.
Yeah, he was using the wrong camera. He was using that sort of two lens camera that he actually used a camera like that actually later in his career. His original camera was really small. It was sort of the size of like a photo camera at the time, maybe a little bigger, but it was awfully small. And I think that's what he actually used to shoot his street scene.
They do sort of show a lot of his work with celluloid film, which is accurate, and they do his death scene in the end I think is also accurate. He showed up at like a film conference and then spoke and then died after he sat down.
Yeah, like abruptly died.
Yeah.
That's not funny.
No, it's not, but it's sort of the statement that probably a lot of people wish they sent, and he actually did that. It's a very cinematic moment, but it really happened.
It supposedly really happened that way, right?
Yeah,
that
he
gave a very impassioned speech and then died very publicly. And I think we mentioned in the last episode that England was they were full of guilt. You know, within hours after his death, people sort of figured out who he was, and he got this grand funeral that was paid for, like, by the state. Yeah.
Yeah, by the state, yeah. Interesting.
And then his grave says that he's the inventor of cinematography.
That's nice. I mean, that's nice.
I mean, great. He's their guy.
Yeah.
He's England's boy.
Yeah. So, yeah, we did our homework there. So if you're interested, if that sounds interesting to you, go watch it and come talk to us about it in the Discord.
Yeah, it was nice. People love it.
Yeah, it's like Scorsese's favorite film, right?
I don't think it's his favorite, but it's, yeah, people mention that it's, that Martin Scorsese found it very inspiring, that it was among his favorite movies. I've heard. I haven't asked Martin myself. I'm sorry, Mr. Scorsese.
Well, speaking of which, our first subject today has an interesting tie that we sort of discovered last night with one of our favorite directors, and that's Miyazaki.
Oh, well, a suspected tie.
Yeah, yeah, loosely, but we were sort of able to do the 7 degrees of separation thing with that, right?
Possibly. Well, we'll explain. So if the title of the episode means anything to you, then you may know that we're talking about a man named Charles-Emile Reynaud. Neither of us are very good French speakers, so there might be a lot of butchering of French words in this episode, and we will do our best. We're sorry.
I'm really going to try, because coming up in short order here, we're going to be talking about a lot of French people. We started the series with a French person. We're talking about one today, and I think over the next several episodes, there's probably going to be a French dude who we mention, right?
Yeah, the Lumières are French. Mm-hmm. Louis le Prince was French. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that people are, my God, if you speak French, then you're probably even annoyed by that, because it's Louis le Prince.
Le Prince.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm American.
Oh, really? Try. We'll try. We'll try.
We'll try. We're trying.
Max Miller taught me that I should endeavor to not butcher that wherever possible. He does such a good job.
Max Miller. He clearly works really hard on his pronunciations.
Mm-hmm.
So Charles-Emile Reynaud was, you could probably easily credit him with creating the first animated film.
Yeah, definitely.
He created something called the Théâtre Optique, which he patented in 1888, which was essentially a moving picture camera,
mm-hmm.
except that he used painted images instead of photographs.
Right, yeah. But it was very similar to, if you were a Looney Tunes fan, I mean, you can draw basically a direct line between this guy and that, because he was using stationary backgrounds, and the only thing that was moving was the figures in front of it, right?
Oh, yeah. That definitely went on before Looney Tunes.
Well, of course. But, I mean, I'm just trying to refer to something that people listening may have seen.
Oh, okay.
Right. You know what I mean?
So before Reynaud created this insanely complicated device that was the Théâtre Optique, you would have to sort of look up. I had to see a video of it before I understood how complicated it actually was.
Yeah.
Layers of film and different
gears and moving parts.
It's insane.
And mirrors and lights.
And requires a lot of skill to operate it even.
Yeah.
It's like playing an instrument, but with images.
Yeah. It looks incredibly complicated.
So before that, there he created something called the Praxinoscope, mm-hmm. which was like an improvement on the zoetrope, which was just sort of the big circle of images that you view through a slot that just loops round and round.
Yeah.
So he sort of bridged the gap there in an interesting way, that the zoetrope was already invented when he came on the scene. He improved upon that, and then he created something that is essentially a template for what we still use as animation today.
Well, this is easy to sort of walk through the stages of development here, right? You have if you want to think about the bird and the cage thing that you can put in your hand and flip around. So it's just two images, and that gives you a sense of movement or a little trick of the eye that you can see. You know, the cage is empty and there's a bird on the other side, and you flip, and if you move it fast enough, it looks like the bird's in the cage. And then we go from that to like little cylinders that you can view through. So you get like 1 second's worth of movement, you know, the bird flapping its wings. I think we touched on this briefly in the last episode. Right?
If you watched the Magic Box, then William Freeze Green is in a room, and there's a little one in his lamp or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just a little guy sort of dancing around. It's probably, you know, 12 little pictures.
Yeah. So we go through little micro improvements on that until we land on what Charles Reynaud does. And that's, he sort of in some ways, invents the shared viewing experience. He kind of recognized that that was important. You know, you look at these zoetropes and that only one person can sort of look at that at a time.
Right, exactly.
And now he's bringing people into a space where they can all watch the same thing at the same time. And this is even before the Lumières do their thing in 1895, which we'll talk about. Like, he's already sort of figured that out.
Right.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing about the Théâtre Optique is that, unfortunately, there aren't many surviving films. In fact, I think there are two. Is that rather than, like, a film, once it's captured and edited, you can only play it back one way. This was more of a show. He was able to... I mean, if you look it up on YouTube, one of them, then they play them back at a normal frame rate. But he could sort of prolong the movement. He could move it back and forth. It was layered in such a way that he could alter the show ever so slightly. He could make it longer if the audience was really into it, or he could shorten it up if maybe they weren't.
Yeah. Well, it's not getting good. All right, play me off, Johnny. I actually know the name of his piano player, and it was Gaston. Play me off, Gaston. Gaston Poulain, for those of you who care, he actually composed music specifically for the Théâtre Optique. And
the same way that they would play live music with silent film later on.
Yes. So, going to show once again that even though the films were silent, the viewing experience almost surely wasn't. And yeah, I wish I could have been there. I wish I could have been in the audience and experienced. I mean, it must have been so magical.
Well, when you find so there's two surviving Théâtre Optique films, but they're really not that interesting. Not too much happens in Pauvre Pierrot, for example, which is the title of our episode. In fact, I'm not certain what happens in that film at all. I'm going to be honest.
So I think this is my very amateur. This is the hard knocks take. All right, and that is I think they're playing on some popular characters at the time. One of them I know is named the Harlequin.
Which is the one that looks like a clown.
Yeah, it's the one that looks like a clown with the buttons. Yeah, not the one with the fancy coat.
The one that's in, he looks like he's wearing a fencing outfit.
Yeah. The guy who looks like he's wearing a fencing outfit. I'm pretty sure he's called the Harlequin.
Oh, he who jumps over the wall at the beginning.
Yeah, and these are like recurring characters that would have been in like the French version of vaudeville. Like these variety shows or like street performers and stuff. These would have been recognizable characters at the time. But like, I don't know, they look funny. Or weird, I guess, to a modern eye. I don't necessarily have the context to make that make sense, but it's really just sort of a silly little love story or like the story of a tryst, a romantic rendezvous where like two guys are trying to get this girl and
Yeah, they're both trying to woo this woman.
Yeah. And then...
Except that the what did you call him?
The Harlequin.
The Harlequin is like getting drunk and playing the mandolin outside her window,
yeah,
being annoying,
and he hides, and obviously in what would obviously be plain sight, it was silly to a modern eye, but I can see how it would have been very cool back then. The only other surviving film we have, or the only other surviving animation, I guess.
Well, we're counting them as films.
Okay, so the other surviving film we have by Monsieur Reynaud would be it's called Arthur d'une cabine.
Which I don't know what that means.
I don't either.
Pauvre Pierrot means poor Peter or poor Paul.
Poor Paul.
I think.
Yeah, I don't know what Arthur d'une cabine means. I'll look it up after the show or after we record, but feel free to correct me in the Discord chat as well.
Yeah, this film is equally confusing. I definitely need Mr. Reynaud's presentation to tell me what's going on, because it's not clear.
Well, this is like a whole beach scene kind of deal, right? There's a bunch of people diving off of a diving board.
Into the ocean.
Or what appears to be a large body of water. I'll assume it's the ocean.
And there's little cabines.
And then there's like another little
changing tents.
Yeah. And then there's another little scene where this girl goes into the changing tent and this creepy guy just sort of follows her around and then she kicks him in the butt.
Yeah.
Into the water.
Also, at the beginning, a couple jumps in the water and they never emerge again.
Yeah. Huge plot hole there.
Yeah. I'm not sure what that was about. Is that explained?
No. I don't know. No. There's no dialogue. It's just...
Back then, was it explained?
Did they have some reason for that back then?
Because it seems to modern audiences like those people just drowned. One of them straight up falls in and the other one dives in, but they don't come back.
They never come back up. They never re-enter the scene or whatever. We just sort of move on.
Oh my God. Yeah, it's pretty bizarre.
Like all of the stuff that we're watching right now, it's unless it's a side watch. This was available. We found this on YouTube, and the top comment was, "It's the second animated film ever, and we're already at the beach episode." Which, oh my God, absolutely killed me. I laughed about that for 20 minutes for sure.
So, Autour d'une cabine is from 1894, actually, but unfortunately, Mr. Reynaud destroyed the rest of his films and his original théâtre optique, like the device itself. So all we have left is a replica, which I would love to see in real life.
Yeah. It was on display in L.A., right? Earlier this year?
No, last year. There was a whole exhibit about it last year, and I wish that we had been doing this a year ago, but such is life, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder where it is now. If anybody knows, let us know in the Discord.
I think they said in the documentary that at least the man who built it was associated with the Cinématique Française, which is, and I don't know if they house it there at their museum or whatever.
That's even farther away than California.
Forever in Paris.
So we'll link these two little short films down in the description if you want to watch them. Everything's going to be in the public domain until 1929.
Yeah, we'll let you guys know.
I forget.
Yeah, by the time we get there. It changes every year, so we'll let you know.
That's true. So, obviously, Mr. Reynaud was not the only person working on films around this time. There was a lot of experimentation going on in 1892, 1893. There is one viewable Edison film from 1892, which is the blacksmith scene.
Which is really more about dudes drinking beer than any blacksmithing.
They do some hammering, they do some drinking, they do just more hammering, and that's it.
Yeah, what is it? Maybe 10 seconds?
No, it's like 30 or 40 seconds.
Which is pretty long compared to some of the other stuff we've been watching. Compared to like the 10 or 20 frames, like that's definitely the longest thing.
Oh, I'm sorry. Blacksmith scene is 1893.
The last thing I think that's probably worth talking about in our designated era is the beginning of the construction of the Black Maria, right?
Yeah, and the completion in 1893.
Yeah, and we actually have plans, hopefully really soon, maybe by the time we record the next episode, to go down to West Orange and see the Edison Museum, right? Take a little pilgrimage.
If you're not aware of what the Black Maria is, the Black Maria was the world's first movie studio.
Yeah, constructed allegedly by Thomas Edison himself, single-handedly. He hammered every nail.
Yeah, that's what they say. No, they don't.
That's what he would say.
William K. Dixon built it together. They did not have a very long relationship. I think that Dixon was out of Edison's world by 1895 or 1896. Yeah. I don't have that. I don't have anything in front of me, but I'm pretty sure I have that right. Their relationship did not last long. But around this time, they were still working together. And unfortunately, the original Black Maria was demolished in, I think, 1903, maybe, which sounds early, but I believe they had built a better studio by then, and they decided to demolish their first one.
Well, I think it was like, you know, it was like tar paper and, you know, plywood or whatever. It was like rotting and hot and sweaty and gross. And yeah, like it was not.
So in West Orange, there is the Thomas Edison National Memorial Park.
Yeah.
I believe. And they have a replica of Black Maria. It wasn't actually, Black Maria is a nickname as well. It was actually just called the Edison Studio or something boring like that. Yeah. Black Mariah was supposed to be, it wasn't a flattering nickname. I don't know why. Maybe nobody liked the name Mariah back then. I'm not sure. It was black and hot.
Yeah, I'm not sure what connotation the name Mariah had.
But I don't know.
Yeah, there's something that I don't understand.
But they called it that because it was terrible to work there. Because they didn't have,
there was no air conditioning. Yeah. Well, they barely had electricity.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, they didn't have electricity. They were using the sun. So that's why it was black.
Well, and that's why they could open up a bunch of, like, the whole roof was hinged. So they could open it up to the sun and get the right light.
Right.
Like,
which is fascinating. That's a brilliant idea.
Right. But then you let all that sun into this black thing and it just gets hot as hell. Like,
right. And the costumes and the makeup, once they started doing that, sounds terrible. Oof. But I think they have like kinetoscopes and some fun stuff there. I mean, Edison was obviously kind of a dick, but.
So we'll offer a little bit more of a full explanation. Or whatever, we'll tell you guys what we learned about that. We'll either insert it into an upcoming episode, or maybe we'll do a standalone episode if we think there's enough to do that.
Yeah, we're thinking about doing some kind of accompanying YouTube channel of us going to some filming locations and some things like this, the Black Mariah replica.
Yeah.
So if you guys are interested in that, then let us know on the Discord if you want to see.
Yeah, we don't really have enough content to be posting regularly, but when we do go, if you'd like to maybe see that rather than hear it, yeah, let us know. Oh, we never did the connection between Miyazaki and Reynaud, which is so typical us. We digressed and then moved on.
So there's an interesting effect that the existing Reynaud films have. The characters are moving in front of a static background, but because of the way that they were layered over top of it, they look like they're transparent.
Yeah, they almost look like ghosts.
Yeah, and they do a really similar effect to that in Spirited Away, which is a Miyazaki movie.
Right, because they make Chihiro progressively more see-through.
Right, she has to eat food or she'll disappear.
Yeah, so with that fresh in my mind, as we were watching Cinema Optique, my French.
Poivre Pierrot.
I thought out loud, like, you know, I would be unsurprised if someone like Miyazaki hadn't been influenced by this. And you pointed out, we couldn't be sure that he was influenced by this, but another early animator who we're going to talk about shortly.
So, right, very little happens in animation until a man called Winsor McCay, who we'll get to, he created a comic strip called Little Nemo in Slumberland. And if you've ever seen the 80s movie Little Nemo, which I loved as a child, there's some really interesting names attached there, if you look it up, including Brad Bird, Chris Columbus, and Hayao Miyazaki.
Woot, woot. Yeah, so there is an interesting tie-in, even though it's not really directly to Reynaud.
But you don't have to go too much farther back from McKay to get to Reynaud.
It's only a couple of years, which, you know, seems short, but there's going to be a lot of development. But yeah, that's pretty cool.
So I don't know for a fact that Hayao Miyazaki has seen both of those films we talked about earlier.
It would surprise me greatly if he hadn't.
Right, but yeah. I believe strongly that he has.
I strongly believe that he has.
That he absolutely knows who this man is.
If you have an opinion about that, please come tell us in our Discord at hardknocks_film.
Come join the discussion about that. I thought that was fascinating when I looked that up, because I watched that movie 1,000 times as a kid.
I'd never seen it, but you showed it to the kids, and that was pretty good. Probably best viewed when you're...
It's not without its flaws.
A little person, though.
It's definitely better as a kid.
Yeah.
All right. Does that cover it for 1892 to 1893?
I think so. I feel pretty good about those particular topics.
Soon we'll have real films to watch.
Coming up, yeah. In the meantime, come follow us on social media. We'll update you guys there about coming topics and episodes. You can find us on Instagram at hardknocks_film, on Discord, as we've said a couple times, at hardknocks_film. You can find Chloe and I individually on Instagram if you care to follow us. I'm at Timville. She's at Black Beacon Sound, and we hope to see you guys back here for the next one.
And hopefully we'll make it to the Edison National Memorial Park. I hope that's right. That's right, right?
I think so.
Whatever. The Edison Place.
Yeah. The Edison Place. Yeah. The old Edison Place.
It's really all about the Black Mariah.
Yeah.
And I think that they have kinetoscopes and stuff there. I could be wrong.
Even if they're reproductions, I'm excited to see all that.
Yeah, that would be fun.
So tune in, and we'll inform you on that as well.
See you next time.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
I won the being ready contest. Just want everybody to know.
He's better than me. It's been established.
I'm stronger.
On a recording.
I'm more attractive.
I think that's apples and oranges. You're the orange. I'm the apple.
What? Well, you're the apple of my eye, babe. Because I love you. I
can't believe you called me an apple.
I can't believe you called me an orange. So fucking rude.
An orange.
An orange. An arch.
An orange.
An orange.
Have you ever heard somebody that actually said it like orange?
Yeah. Orange. Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, yeah. Orange. Yes. You forget where I grew up.
Is that that must be
a regional thing. Like, I don't know if it's a Chicago thing specifically, but like people had weird accents where I grew up. So yeah, I've heard all sorts of shit.
Orange.
It's an orange.
Orange.
Yeah.
Orange. Is it one syllable or two?
It's orange. I think it's one syllable.
Oh, no. I say it as two. I say orange.
Okay, well, like, how does the dictionary tell you to pronounce it?
Orange.
Orange. I guess it's two syllables.
It is, yeah.
Orange.
I slurred into one. Sorry, everybody out there in podcast land. I thought I didn't have an accent, but it turns out I do, and it's only one specific word.
That's why nothing rhymes with orange, because nobody can even agree on how it's pronounced.
Orange.
Okay.
Anyhoozle.
You ready?
Any Hootie and the Blowfish.
Oh.